I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. By the year 1882, 300,000 Chinese immigrants had come to the United States. The vast majority of them were laborers in mines, on the railroad, in the garment industry, in factories, in agriculture. A very small minority, by comparison, of those 300,000 were musicians, theatrical performers, and other sorts of entertainers. And I'm going to toss into the mix magicians as well. Today we are going to hear the tale of Qingling Fu, whose reputation has come down in history in such a way that it's safe to say he was not just a celebrity, he was a phenomenon, actually a superstar. Call him the preeminent Chinese-American performer at the turn from the 19th to 20th centuries. Samuel Porteous is with us here to tell us the story of Qingling Fu. Porteous is a Shanghai-based artist and writer with close to 20 years' experience living and working in China. He is author of Qingling Fu, America's First Chinese Superstar. Samuel Porteous, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
What was your point of entry into the whole story? I mean, magic and the life of magicians or history. What got you going on this?
The theme of a lot of my work is what you could describe as China in the Western imagination, particularly popular culture. I look at instances where Chinese characters or individuals have come to the fore. And in examining that history, I came across an individual, Qingling Fu, who would, of course, be William Robinson, who famously died on stage and was revealed, in fact, to be an American pretending to be a Chinese. And in researching William Robinson, I found that William Robinson's whole act was based on a magician called Qingling Fu. And that is what instigated my research and analysis on Qingling Fu's life and this whole book.
So it's so fascinating to me that Robinson would be the one that gets remembered, I guess, because of his death.
Marcus, I think that's absolutely right, because I'll give you a quick how this unfolded. Qingling Fu comes to America. He's already established in Asia as a major magician. There's the World's Fair in Omaha in 1898. Fu arrives in America, performs at the Chinese Pavilion. The new technologies are here, the wire services, the phone, all the ingredients to create what is now the new celebrity are there. And Fu becomes one. He becomes one of the biggest celebrities in the U.S., China exclusion era U.S., which, again, is ironic. And Robinson observes all this. Robinson is a genius, a technical genius. He's the much sought after assistant of Herman and Keller, the two greatest magicians, American magicians at that time, who fight over his services. Robinson wants to become a magician himself, but he lacks certain stage presence and other skills. He observes Fu with his genius, and he recognizes that performing as a Chinese magician removes much of the impediments he has to be on stage. Robinson had a nasal sounding voice. He wasn't very impressive on the stage. But he realizes that Fu is, as you indicated earlier, the preeminent magician or one of the preeminent magicians in turn of the century America. He can't simply show up as a Chinese magician in America and hope to challenge Fu. So he wisely hops over to London and becomes the great phenomenon in London and Europe as a Chinese magician, pretending to be a Chinese magician. He dies on stage, and that is what triggers his fame later in the U.S. So historically, it was Fu was the famous Chinese magician in the U.S., but only laterly, after Robinson was killed on stage, did he overtake Fu in the mythos, mainly in retrospect. There were like 6-7 books written about Robinson and his life.
There's such drama in that demise of Robinson that just and ironically, we've already upstaged Fu a little just by talking so much about Robinson. But
always happens. Yes, correct.
And we're going to have to talk about the death in greater detail in a moment. But let's just paint the picture of what it would be like to see one of these Chinese magicians performing in the United States, say at the World's Fair. What kinds of acts would you see?
Okay. And again, Fu was the first. He was the originator of the Chinese Magician Act, as it was known in North America, and became famous. Fu had several illusions he would perform. He performed what would be described as traditional Chinese magic, and magic that had been performed for, you know, 1,000 years in China. But he performed it in a way that was exceptional, in the same way you would say that, you know, someone is a singer. Well, it's very different to be a singer and Ella Fitzgerald. And that was the level of genius that Fu had for magic. His illusions contained the traditional Chinese, what you call production illusions, where you would produce something out of nothing. But whereas earlier performers would produce smaller objects, less impressive objects, Fu would produce out of nothing, or under his, you know, 4-foot by 4-foot, you know, heavily decorated shawl, a large crystal bowl of water containing maybe 80 pounds of water, 2 squawking ducks, goldfish, and all sorts of other things. He was a fire performer. He would produce great volumes of smoke that would fill the auditorium from his mouth, and flames and balls of fire would spurt from him. He would do a decapitation illusion where he would seem to lop off the head of his assistant, remove it from his shoulders, and then place it again on his shoulders. The assistant would then walk off the stage none the worse. And he did close-up illusions. One of the very famous ones that caught the attention of many magicians in the U.S. was paper tearing, where he would tear paper seemingly into endless bits and then restore it all into one long stream. So he was quite versatile and very impressive.
Would you also paint a picture of what the venues were like for these kinds of performances in America? Are we talking about small crowds or big, and where?
Very good question. Again, this is also an era of technological disruption. The era that Fu first arrived in, he did 2 major tours, 1898 to 1900 with the World's Fair. Then he came back 1912, 1915, and did it again, the most popular, most famous performer in vaudeville in the U.S. And it was vaudeville, and vaudeville was live theater. And even when Fu first appeared in 1898, Thomas Edison had just shown his first commercial film in 1896. So what you saw was that live theater, which was the predominant form of entertainment in the day, was gradually being overtaken by film. And Fu saw that, and Fu was a polymath, and Fu ultimately would own movie theaters in China, and he would make China's first documentary film. But it was live theaters. The venues were enormous. Many of these venues would be converted, simply converted to film. And they would hold 3,000, 4,000 people, even more in New York. And they were all over the country. So, you know, you would have these vaudeville theaters in mid-size and small, you know, small cities and even large towns. It was an enormous enterprise of live entertainment. And it was all ultimately destroyed by film.
So Ching Ling Fu was more than a performer. He was a businessman, and he had a pretty big outfit going. It sounds to me like he was up there with, you know, the big showman of the day.
Yes, there was always the mix in Fu's life between mercantile and magic. In fact, back in 1890, when he was only 26, he joined a major Chinese trading company. And he was a partner in a major trading Chinese trading company that had offices in San Francisco, Beijing, Tianjin, his hometown, and Shanghai. And he also, as we indicated earlier, he saw this new technology emerging in the U.S. and he recognized its potential. And he set up a chain of film theaters in China. And he actually recorded the first Chinese music and singing that had ever been recorded.
So he must have been making a lot of money, but he began just a humble fellow, a little kid in Tianjin, you said. Can you tell us about his childhood and what may have put him on this road to becoming a magician, to becoming such a success as an entertainer?
He was born, what I like to divide this information in the two categories in the book is what we've been told and what we know. And what we've been told about Fu's earlier life is that he was born around 1854 into the city of Tianjin, which is one of the major cities in China, a coastal city, port city, about 80 miles from Beijing. It was a hugely cosmopolitan city at the time Fu would have been growing up. I think there were about 10 different countries that had what you call concessions in Tianjin, which means they had a chunk of the city that was under their control, under their law. And that was a result of the Opium Wars and the concessions that China had to make after the Opium Wars. So he would have seen a huge variety of people, and he was apparently immensely influenced by the street magicians you would see at the time in such a city, and the gamblers, because there were card-sharp gamblers in many instances, and they fascinated him as a young boy, watching them play cards and use their tricks.
That's the inherited conventional wisdom. Is it accurate? Mm. I mean, is that fair? What do we really know?
Yeah, it is. Like in my research, what I put forward in the book, I say this is what has been said and is most credible. So in that context about, you know, his early life. And one of the things that is said is that he spent 5 years at a school for conjurers in Tianjin and then later toured Asia. What we do know is that he was a very famous magician even before he came to America in 1898. He did perform before the Chinese royal family. He did perform at the request of the Hong Kong governor, the British governor of Hong Kong, and the British governor of Singapore. And he performed before mixed audiences of Chinese and Western, and Chinese audiences exclusively, and exclusively Western audiences. And he was seen as a genius and a phenomenon, and this is important, in front of both Chinese audiences and Western audiences. Because understand, Chinese magic has an enormously long history. So one of the, you know, criticisms might have been that the audience was, to use a quote, wearily familiar with all the various, you know, tricks and illusions. And what Fu was able to do was give new life to those for even a Chinese audience that had seen it all before.
Well, the story of bridging from China to America is really interesting to me, because it seems to me if he was legit, if he was the real thing back in China and people knew it, he had his fame, he had his audiences, his followers, then you got to establish yourself in a new country. It seems to me that maybe the endorsement of the people back home is what got him on stage at that World Fair in the Chinese Pavilion.
Certainly that's the case. Remember, this was, again, Chinese Exclusion Act era America. So, in fact, the Manchu government at the time did not participate, as they didn't participate in the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago because of the American China Exclusion Act. So it was, in fact, American Chinese businessmen that invested in the Chinese Pavilion. And they are the ones that would ultimately have engaged Fu to come to Omaha and star at the Chinese theater as part of the Chinese Pavilion for the World's Fair, where he caught on like fire. And as we indicated earlier, all the modern new technologies for communications, the wire services, you know, cameras, the box camera, the first year it came out was 1898. All these fed into Fu's fame.
Now, you also tell that he wasn't necessarily just a solo act. This was kind of a family thing going on. His son, his wife, young daughter. What was their role?
The appeal of Fu, particularly, again, in this period in the U.S., when most people, if, you know, if they ever saw a Chinese person, that would have been predominantly in California, on the West Coast, and, you know, very few places outside of that. They would have seen Chinese workers, Chinese laborers. There were also the Chinese merchant class, which was a very small sliver of those allowed to enter the country. But families they did not see, particularly women and children. So the idea of seeing a Chinese family was something that was unique or certainly intriguing, even on the West Coast. And the Fu performance, his family was part of it. His son was a young teenager, was a contortionist and talented acrobat. His wife participated in the show. His daughter, Chitoy, was an adorable toddler who was bilingual, who could sing ragtime songs in English, delighting the audience. And it was sort of a Cirque du Soleil, because remember, Cirque du Soleil basically just borrowed the traditional Chinese circus and, you know, adjusted it in a certain manner. So what you saw on the Foo show was sort of a modern Cirque du Soleil type performance, a variety act, if you will, with Foo at the center.
We are going to get to the story of the rivalry between Qingling Fu and Cheng Ling Su, or William Robinson, his actual name. Before we do any of this, could you just mention briefly the fact that somebody tried to deport him at some time during his stay in the United States?
Yes. Everything happened to Fu. Remember, again, China Exclusion Act, I have to keep saying that. So there had to be a special act of Congress passed in order to issue the visas for the Chinese who came to America to help create the Chinese Pavilion. There were about 250 artists, workers, carpenters, all who were brought over from China to help build the China Pavilion, house it, and, you know, do all the things that needed to be done. And Lionel Gage was the name of the, I believe it was the Treasury Secretary at the time, and he put in a special act through Congress that granted visas to each of the Chinese participants coming over. And those visas lasted up to 3 months after the end of the World's Fair. So what happened to Fu and his troupe was his enormous fame at the during the 1898 World's Fair resulted in all the, you know, the theater impresarios of the day flooding to Omaha and trying to sign him to perform in their theater chains, their vaudeville chains at the time. And this is what, in fact, happened to Fu. And so for that period, he was making enormous amounts of money. There was a very colorful gentleman called Colonel Hopkins, who was the owner of the major Midwestern vaudeville chain that went from Chicago down to New Orleans. And he was the first to recognize Fu's genius and his potential in the American market. And he was one of the early, really experts at what was called booming at the time. And that was basically promotion. So when he saw Fu, he realized what Fu could do. And being a genius, he said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to pay this guy in 1898, $1,000 a week. That became a pivotal part of his promotion because people would go, holy cow, this guy's paid $1,000 a week in 1898, and we better go see what he does. What happened is, of course, enormous success, all this money being made. Again, entertainment conglomerates were emerging. There was this huge Midwestern vaudeville circuit, the largest vaudeville circuit, Keith's on the East Coast with the major Eastern cities, New York, Philadelphia, etc. They wanted Fu now. There was a deal being hatched between Colonel Hopkins and his chain and the major East Coast vaudeville chain. And Fu was part of that deal. And then all of a sudden, in pops the immigration authorities arresting Fu in Chicago in 1899, March 1899, for violating, you know, his visa. And they want to, you know, the argument is he has to return to China. And if I could just add one last thing, it wasn't reported that way in the papers initially. It was reported that the Chinese emperor wanted Fu back. And that's why he was arrested and being sent back to China. Not because of something as mundane as a visa, you know, expiring. No, no, it was the emperor of China demanding to see his conjurer. And so the U.S. government reluctantly arrested Fu to send him back to the emperor. And this was all April 1st for some of this initial reporting.
Well, you know, everything had to be writ large in those days. And so if you're going to have headlines, and we're talking about yellow journalism, too, perhaps in the mix there. So he does not get deported ultimately. What allows him to stay?
Well, again, everything, the whole structure, this is what I find interesting in the book, the technological disruptions, the emergence of the celebrity culture, the whole infrastructure was being built. Entertainment lawyers emerged. The B.F. Keith's, the huge vaudeville, you know, conglomerate similar to Warner Brothers or Sony today, starts getting their lawyers involved. And there's a, you know, one of the first entertainment lawyers who cut his teeth with Barnum and Bailey is brought in. And he's huge, you know, major lawyers to fight this case. And on the administrative level, they say they've got no choice. Fu has to return. But on the appeal level at the Chicago Court of Appeals, before Judge Colsat, the entertainment lawyers argue, and the judge rules, that the Exclusion Act applies to laborers and that Fu, as an artist, can stay in America as long as he wants.
That's a little bit of a loophole. It makes me want to be an entertainer. You know.
In fact, 90% of the headlines, you know, because it was covered daily. This was like one of the, you know, endless trials of the century we always see. It was at its time the trial of the century, covered everywhere because of the new media, front page newspapers. 90% of the response to the judgment was, yay, you know, Fu gets to stay. But there was a percentage that was just what you said. You know, the China Exclusion Act is being filled with loopholes. Everyone is going to want to dress themselves up as a Shakespearean actor, thunder across the stage and get into the U.S. So that dichotomy, that tension between the enormous welcome Fu received and that ongoing tension with the China Exclusion Act and xenophobia continued.
Samuel Porteous is with us. He's author of Ching Ling Fu, America's First Chinese Superstar, the story of this magician who makes his way to the 1898 World's Fair in Omaha, sticks around. He's an international superstar by this point. And this story eventually takes us to London. It's the story of the rivalry with William Robinson. You've mentioned him already, Samuel, this William Robinson. He's kind of a knockoff, isn't he? He's trying to imitate and capitalize on the success of Ching Ling Fu. Even the name Cheng Ling Su is intentional, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. It was calculated to cause confusion, and it has for the 100 or so years since the two first sort of knocked heads. And you have to understand, with Fu, there were myriad copycats for him. Like anything else, he was an enormous success. So even in his first tour, 1898 to 1900, it generated all sorts of yellow face copycats and genuine Chinese copycats. But the thing was, none of these copycats ever got anywhere near the success of Fu, because his unique charisma, his unique stage presence, he was a superstar. People wanted to go see him. And people would say, well, we know how he does these tricks. There would be newspaper articles published saying this is how Fu does his tricks, usually informed by a slightly jealous magician. And people didn't care. They kept coming again and again to see Fu. And there was a real magnetism with him. So all these copycats, they flooded the system, had their impact, but never achieved anywhere near his success. Robinson was observing all this, the technical genius Robinson. And he rightly decided that the best spot, if he was going to copy Fu, would be someplace where the market didn't know about Fu, or hadn't seen Fu yet. And Fu had been receiving all these invitations to travel to Europe, perform in Europe, and perform in London. And for a number of reasons, he actually decided to return to China. He was fed up, usual contract negotiations, et cetera, et cetera. He returned to China, but this opened the window for Robinson to head over to London, dress up as a Chinese magician, call himself Cheng Ling Su, and do the Fu act in a market that had not yet seen Fu.
Now, there's a little bit of a footnote here that I want to explore with you, which has to do with the appetite in these days among Americans for things that were exotic. And so if you're going to be a magician, you can't be an American magician and get quite the crowd as if you're from ports distant. You know, you're going to be Chinese, you're going to be Hindu or something.
I think that's true to extent, Marcus, but actually the biggest magicians of the time, and again, this is such a complex topic. The entertainment universe at that time was live theater, we remember, right? And the biggest stars of live theater, it's hard to understand now, the biggest stars of live theater were magicians. And there were magic shops everywhere in the U.S. The magic industry was enormous. You know, it was part of the entertain yourself environment that had to exist because there was no radio. There was no television. There were no films. Most people, you had to play the piano or entertain. And magic is enormous in a way it just is not today. But the major magicians in the U.S. were Herman, Keller, Lafayette, and others like them. But Herman and Keller, they were the iconic evening tuxedo, tightly fit tuxedo with, you know, the mustache. Those were those guys. But you're right that a subgenre of that magic entertainment was the exotic performer. But very important to say in the context of Fu that he was not what was called at that time merely a race act, right? People did not go to see Fu simply because he was exotic. There was a wonderful line by a Variety analyst and editor. Their job was to analyze these acts and, you know, assess them. And I found the archives for that. And in assessing Fu, he said, like, this act is not a race act. He said, you know, there have been hundreds of Chinese performers who've appeared in the U.S. before Fu, magician and otherwise, and they've never had Fu's impact. And these other acts, he said, if they were simply race acts, would end up in what he called country circuses. So very important, the exoticism was part of it, but when it came to Fu, he very much transcended that.
Well, if you were to bracket off then the idea that these were not race acts, was there not still some kind of a hint of the ancient secrets, the mystic across the ocean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that would have been the commonality with all the sort of Chinese magicians and performers and other Asian performers at that time. But the key thing is that Fu transcended that. And he did this wonderful bridging between the cultures. They used to have these dinners where the entertainers. Fu was enormously charismatic and popular amongst the other entertainers. And they used to have these huge dinners, and all the entertainers would come, and it would be on the roof of the theater at Hammerstein's. And, you know, they have a wonderful Chinese dinner. And he was enormously popular with the American magicians. Martinkus was the Hogwarts headquarters of magic tricks and things like that that would sell them in New York. And he would go there and kibitz with all the magicians who were coming there to develop illusions. And he was enormously popular.
Now, what exactly did Robinson steal from Fu's act, if I can be so blunt?
Yeah, basically everything. So if you looked at the, you know, what Robinson's initial act in London was when he first went over, it was basically a photocopy of Fu's act, right down to, you know, the family, right? The presentation of the Chinese family. So he basically did the production tricks. He did all of Fu's illusions. He even created a Chinese family that, of course, wasn't really his. Fu's daughter, Chitoy, was matched by Robinson's created offspring, Bamboo Flower, who was actually the daughter of one of his half-Japanese assistants, a very important part of his act. So, he basically took everything. Later on, because Robinson was a genius and a technical genius, his act evolved to include more traditional Western illusions. But initially, his was basically a Fu act, and it was recognized as such in the U.S. People writing in the U.S. who knew what was going on would say, hey, by the way, William Robinson is over in London, and he's doing a Fu act. And there was an article published in Cosmopolitan, a major magazine in the U.S. at that time, major circulation, about the great magicians. And under a photo of Robinson was the text, and it's in my book, The Imitator of Qingling Fu. So this is one of the reasons Robinson never performed as Qingling Fu in America. He knew that it was best for him to stay on his side of the Atlantic, because everybody in America and North America knew who was who as far as being the original Chinese conjurer.
How successful was he at disguising himself?
To the Chinese audience, of course, they would look at Robinson and, you know, they would say, oh my goodness, he's wearing those Chinese clothes backwards. That is actually a woman's article of clothing. It was pretty clear to anyone who was Chinese what was up with Robinson. But, you know, he gradually refined that. But, you know, initially it was pretty clear. To a London audience, the general audience was pretty much willing to, you know, put up with the illusion. The professionals, the entertainment class in the U.S., they knew who Robinson was. They knew he wasn't Chinese. It was sort of a shared secret. The newspapers in London, to a certain extent, as the act went on, because of like when Fu arrived in 1905 and made his challenge and said, this is not, he's not Chinese. Like, they knew that there was something up, and Robinson had to adapt his illusion. He had to start saying, okay, I'm half Chinese. My father was Scottish. My mother was Chinese. I grew up in Guangdong province. So the illusion was strong amongst the general uninitiated audience. Those that were closer to the entertainment world knew better. And as time went on, journalists also had a pretty good idea that this wasn't 100%.
Now, you said they go head to head. I think you said the year was 1905.
Yes. What happened was Fu had returned to China, and he walked right into the 1900 Boxer Rebellion, which, of course, was centered in his hometown, Tianjin. And a huge economic, psychological, and medical impact on him, business impact as well. It took a long time for him to recover from that, all the upheaval. By the time he did that, and of course, what was interesting in the American media, the Boxer Rebellion was being covered heavily with the new media film and things like that. And one of the big questions in the American media, because Fu was such an enormous star, was how is Fu? What's happening to Fu? How is the Fu family in China? And there would be this correspondence. Letters from Fu would arrive in America. Albee, who was the head of B.F. Keith's theater chain, would publish the letters in the major newspapers where Fu would account what had happened to him post-Boxer Rebellion. And as he recovered, the ironic thing is the immigration laws in the U.S. as regards the Chinese became even tighter. So Fu's management found it even more difficult than the initial time to bring the troupe into America to perform. And it was decided at that point it was probably easier to go to Europe, where they'd performed before, and go to London. So plans were made to go to London. And in the course of, you know, planning to go to London, they, of course, encountered Cheng Ling Su, William Robinson, already occupying the space in London, and very egregiously using Fu's own advertising slogans, the original Chinese conjurer. Like, Robinson was nothing if not full of chutzpah, right? So Fu arrives in London and sees this copycat who, you know, not only copies his act, he copies his life, he copies his promotion model, and it was decided to go hard. His managers, who were very rambunctious, the Musser brothers, decided they were going to, you know, they came out of the circuses, they were really going to go hard at Robinson and his team and take him down.
Who wins?
That's another interesting question. And that is one. And this is the great mystery, because, again, the information on Fu that lingered in the popular mind all relates to this contest. Because, you know, as we said, Fu was much, much more famous in the U.S. than Robinson was Cheng Ling Su. But these days, people, if they remember anything, remember Robinson, and they remember the world competition of and Fu as the Chinese guy who challenged Robinson in the World Championship of Chinese Magic in 1905. And who won? What was interesting is Houdini, who was a friend of both men, and who described Fu as a super magician in his book, was acting as a judge. So the newspapers saw this as an amazing circulation builder. You know, you have one Chinese magician, one Chinese wizard appearing in London, issuing a challenge to, you know, the existing Chinese wizard and favorite of the public in London. And the newspapers, yellow journalism, you mentioned, went crazy, making up things about their, you know, age-old rivalry and things like that, pumping it up. And so there was this enormous publicity, and there was very acrimonious accusations back and forth. Fu saying, this man is not Chinese, he's a fraud, right? Robinson coming back saying, this is a street corner juggler, you know, this is a caste issue. I don't want to compete with him because he's so beneath me. And of course, the real fear for Robinson was that if he got in the same room with Fu, Fu would pull off his fake cue or speak Chinese to him or expose him in any number of ways. So Robinson desperately tried to dodge the competition initially, but all the pressure, all the media forced him to accept the challenge. And as I said, Houdini, who was in London at the time and loved publicity and knew both men, thought it would be great publicity to act as a judge, and he did so. But on the day the big challenge was to take place, the great mystery was, as the time came and, you know, Robinson arrived with his colorful entourage and was sitting there sweating bullets that he would have to face Fu. Fu, when the time came, ultimately didn't show up. So all these frantic calls were made, calls to Fu's hotel, calls to his management. What's happening? Where is Fu? Is he showing up? Fu never showed up. Not until 7 o'clock. And Robinson, you know, did the 10 Chinese illusions. He was asked to do 10 of 20. He did those. He was declared the winner. Important to understand, that wasn't the extent of Fu's challenge. Fu also said he wasn't Chinese and that he wanted the Chinese legation to be there to verify, you know, Su/Robinson was Chinese. He also wanted Robinson to show that he had ever done any act like this before he saw Fu's act in 1898 in the U.S. at the World's Fair. They ignored those first two challenges and only focused on the magic portion. That was one reason that Fu did not show up. But what I established for the first time that had never been established was the real reason Fu did not show up for that challenge. And that, I believe, from the research I did and analysis, was that the Chinese legation in London, the Chinese diplomats, asked Fu to go easy on Robinson.
Wow.
Why would they do that? You have to go back to the World's Fair in 1898 in Omaha. Who goes to the World's Fair in 1898 in Omaha? President McKinley goes to the World's Fair. Why does President McKinley go to the World's Fair in Omaha? President McKinley goes to the World's Fair in Omaha because the Spanish-American War has just ended. What happened after the Spanish-American War? America became a Pacific power. It was the first Pacific pivot. America acquired the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. They acquired Cuba. They acquired Guam. Guam is still an American territory. The Philippines obviously is no longer a colony, right? But because the Americans became a Pacific power, the ambassador to America from China, a guy called Wu Ting-Fang, traveled to Omaha with McKinley, and they both gave speeches on world peace at the end of the Spanish-American War. And in fact, Hawaii was also acquired by America in 1898 through a lot of, you know, shenanigans with the Dole Pineapple Company and an insurrection that was organized by the pineapple, you know, the American companies, and then overtaken by the U.S. government. Hawaii became part of America. So, you know, America all of a sudden was this huge Pacific presence. Wu Ting-Fang was there to lobby in Omaha. He was there to lobby President McKinley so the China Exclusion Act did not apply to the Philippines, because it would have been disastrous for China because they did so much business with the Philippines. And in Omaha, Wu Ting-Fang met Chingling Fu, and they became very good acquaintances, if not friends. And Wu Ting-Fang actually negotiated the last part of Fu's contract in Washington with B.F. Keith's before Fu returned to China. So this relationship with Fu, and he received several flags, like because of the good work he was doing in people-to-people diplomacy, you know, building better relations. Because, of course, you have to remember at that time, all the popular entertainment about China was opium, it was deceit, it was, you know, the heathen Chinese. And then Fu and his family show up, and all of a sudden there's this positive coverage. So the, you know, the Chinese legation in the U.S. thought it was great, and they presented American and Chinese flags to Fu on stage to great applause about improving the relations between the two countries. So one of the first things that, you know, Fu did when he arrived in London, of course, was to visit the Chinese embassy, pay his respects. And, you know, following forward, China, as always, was having a hard time in the West. And there were stories about Chinese sailors taking jobs from, you know, British sailors. There were stories about Limehouse, you know, where Sax Rohmer would emerge with Fu Manchu in late, you know, in a decade or so, about corruption, vice, and opium. And there were all these different issues that had arisen. And Robinson was a positive story. Even though he was a bit of a joke and anyone that was Chinese knew he was not Chinese, he did work very hard to keep positive relations with the Chinese, local Chinese communities, because he had to. Because, of course, he knew, they knew that, you know, 9 times out of 10, this guy is not Chinese. But he would keep his distance and argue this sort of caste issue and have intermediaries sort of work with them. But it was clear who he was. But the Chinese legation, I argue, would have said to Fu, this man that you want to expose and ruin, he is obviously not Chinese, but he does serve a purpose in that he is presenting a positive presentation of China and Chinese culture, even if it is sort of distorted. It's better than what we're getting for all these, you know, opium and Limehouse scandals and all this pulp culture tropes about the Chinese that we have to deal with. The idea was that Fu, presented with that argument, walked away from the contest and did not destroy Robinson. And it is proven by the fact that after that contest, Fu never once responded to any of the needling, constant needling for 2 years at least, he got from Robinson. Robinson went on an extended 2-year victory lap, publishing these enormous ads where he described himself as the champion and the, you know, the defeater of the dreaded Qingling Fu. And Fu was an enormously proud man. And there was no way he or his management would have put up with any of that and said nothing if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, Fu had his good reasons not to take Robinson down.
So we got going on this whole saga with the name William Robinson, the Qingling Fu wannabe, the imitator. And we mentioned that he was killed on stage. The details of when the curtain came down for him still to come. Samuel Porteous is with us, author of Qingling Fu, America's First Chinese Superstar. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. 1918, the death of Robinson. He's on stage. He gets shot.
That's correct. He does say, well, this again relates back to the whole China and the West relationship. Because, of course, you know, Robinson copies Fu's act, hightails it to London in 1900 to a fresh market who doesn't know who Fu is, has tremendous success. But what happens in the midst of building his act, the Boxer Rebellion occurs. And all of a sudden, the audiences start getting hostile to the Chinese performer because they're getting all this news about, you know, Christian missionaries being harassed and attacked, throwing out the Western forces in China. And he has to figure out from a PR perspective, how do I deal with this? And of course, once again, he copies Fu. Because remember, we talked about Fu's experience in the Boxer Rebellion and how all the newspaper reports talked about how Fu was dealing with the Boxer Rebellion and the challenges he faced and the enormous interest in the U.S. Robinson, of course, the great student of Fu, was following all this very closely. And he said, aha, that's it. I can position myself as the good Chinese. In his idea, the good Chinese were opposed to the Boxers, the bad Chinese supported the Boxers. So what Robinson would do is present himself to the European and British audience as the good type of Chinese who opposed the Boxer Rebellion, right? And how did he do that? He created a new illusion, again, talking through his hat, said he had gone to China secretly to battle the Boxer Rebellion. And while he was in China secretly, he was captured by the Boxers and he was going to be executed. And through his magic, he was able to escape from the execution, the firing squad, and return to London. And so he recreated this illusion of escape from the Boxers, which was, you know, a standard what you call bullet capture illusion, where three riflemen with muzzle-loaded guns would face Robinson, who would hold a magic plate which would capture the bullets. Well, on this night in 1918, you know, the guns he had used for over a decade, one of them malfunctioned. And instead of firing mere sparks and, you know, flare from the end, actually fired the bullet that was hidden in the real portion of the rifle. And that bullet did its job because of a crack in the rifle that had formed over years and years of use. And it traveled through the plate and into Robinson's chest. And he was severely wounded, fell on stage shouting, close the curtains, something's gone wrong. And of course, he said that in English, and everyone heard him. And then all the reports came out that he was dead. And then not only was he dead, he was pretending to be Chinese. And that was the revelation that Fu, in fact, was right so many years ago.
So back to Qing Ling Fu, and what happens to his name after he's gone? I mean, is there a legacy of people continuing to admire and imitate his tricks? Are there magical shows today that contain some of the things he did?
Well, we're actually trying to recreate that right now. It's interesting, you look at fame and legacies, and it's almost like radiation half-lives, right? So Fu continued to be very famous. Remember, he had two great tours, 1898, 1900 in the U.S., then 1912, 1915. He headlined the Ziegfeld Follies in his second tour. He was on a tour with Lillian Russell, who was the Oprah Winfrey of her era, right? And Gertrude Hoffman, who was the Lady Gaga of her time. He was the star of that era when it was transitioning into film, and he shared the stage with early Marx Brothers, Mae West, all these characters who were transitioning into film, you know. And the irony is he returned to America as one of the biggest stars in America at the same time the Klansman in 1915 in Los Angeles. He was a big star in Los Angeles performing in the last gasp of vaudeville live theater as film overtook it. And Griffith's film, The Klansman, now known as Birth of a Nation, but its original name was The Klansman, as in KKK. And that controversial film was the big hit of 1915 as Fu was heading back to China. And Charlie Chaplin was just emerging as a star and was referred to, was known as Charles at that time because he hadn't become Charlie. So his fame was enormous, and it lasted up until the 30s. So you would have ads for water companies in the 1930s using Qing Ling Fu's name because one of his illusions was production of water. You would have people selling hats like a Qing Ling Fu hat because it was magic. Again, it was the generation of people who knew him, who grew up. So it would be like Frank Sinatra, sort of, you know, to the extent people are alive who saw him perform and knew how big he was, his fame endures. And the problem with Fu, of course, was there was no real film record of him that was made. The films that were made of him, and there were films made, didn't last because of the unstable nature of the chemicals on the film. And just on that, of course, one of the, you know, he was a huge polymath. Fu also made China's first documentary. One of his strongest legacies is under his real name, Julian Cui. And he is known in China as the father of the documentary film in China. He filmed in 1911 Wuchang Uprising, which was the start of the revolution that led to Sun Yat-sen and the overthrow of the Qing dynasty. So that film had an enormous impact. Talk about a legacy. It had an enormous impact in raising support for Sun Yat-sen and the Republicans and the final overturn of what was seen as a corrupt Qing dynasty. I'd also like to mention Fu is also arguably the grandfather of film special effects. How do we get there? There's a guy called Jerome Ash, who is argued to be the father of film special effects. He is the special effects wizard who did the special effects for the 1930s Flash Gordon serials that are so iconic, and people walking on light beams, people's faces transforming spaceships, like the earliest great special effects. And his special effects were so great that when they promoted Flash Gordon, the Flash Gordon serial, not only the movie stars, but Jerome Ash was also put on the tour to promote the film and the special effects. And during my research, going through archives and interviews and things like that, looking at Jerome Ash's interviews, when he was asked about making these special effects for the film, he basically said this was easy. Working on a studio lot with a bunch of technicians to create these illusions was nothing compared to what he had to do when he was working with Qing Ling Fu. And Jerome Ash, of course, was a phenomenon as a young sort of child magician. And he was mentored by Fu. And being a smart guy, as discussed, he realized film was overtaking theater. He moved into film. But when asked about his skill with special effects, he said that everything he knew about optical illusions, he learned from Ching Ling Fu. So there you go. You know, to the polymath's credit, arguably also the grandfather of film special effects.
You've used the word, I think, three or four times now, polymath, and now I believe you. I really do believe you.
Thanks very much.
Samuel Porteous, author of Ching Ling Fu, America's First Chinese Superstar. The story of Fu's life has taken us from Tianjin in China to Omaha, Nebraska, to London, England. That's nearly a tour around the globe. Our next story takes us down under to a museum in Sydney, Australia, where this researcher uncovered something that seems to have generated the same kind of astonishment that came to Ching Ling Fu's spellbound audiences.
The lid of the coffin actually slid off, almost like a pencil box. And so very carefully pulling the lid back, centimeter by centimeter, the lid slowly was pulled all the way back to reveal the inside of the contents. And we all leaned forward. And you could have heard a pin drop. It was astonishing. Because what we were expecting to see was an empty coffin.
Utterly forgotten in the dust of time until that very moment, well, you'll hear soon enough. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder.